Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 9, 2020. Sudan's Sovereign Council condemns assassination attempt on the Sudanese Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister is safe and nothing has hurt him nor anyone from his accompanied team. Only one of the motorcade crew who has a slight injury on his arm after falling down from his motorbike.
And the UN chief in South Sudan has a warning for the warring parties.
The parties in good faith agreed that they would form a unified armed forces. So therefore it's important that we see that through. It's very much a central part of the peace agreement. And if we don't do that, or it seemed to be lagging, then one party or another might feel frustrated, angry. That can create problems.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's transitional government is condemning an assassination attempt which targeted the motorcade of Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok this morning in Khartoum. A Sudanese official calls it an act of terrorism. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudanese Information Minister Faisal Muhammad Saleh says the motorcade of the Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok came under attack this morning by identified gunmen while heading to his office. Speaking in Arabic, Saleh says Hamdok was unharmed.
The Prime Minister is safe and nothing has hurt him nor anyone from his accompanied team. Only one of the motorcade crew who has a slight injury on his arm after falling down from his motorbike. The Prime Minister is now carrying his normal duties in his office.
Saleh says the government is investigating the assassination attempt, what he calls an attempted attack on a Sudanese revolution, and the gains that have been achieved in the last few months.
Our people have witnessed the beginning of a new era and they are capable to defend this at all cost. We use necessary decisive way to deal with all terrorists and distractions attempt to dismantle all roots of the previous regime.
Speaking to reporters in Juba today, a member of the Sudan Sovereign Council, General Shamsuddin Kabashi, also condemned the attack, saying military and civilian members of the government will not allow spoilers to create chaos in the country. Speaking in Arabic, Kabashi says the government's main objectives are to ease economic hardship facing citizens and build a democratic state and achieve lasting peace in Sudan.
As negotiation teams, we call on all Sudanese military and civilians to collectively work towards fighting terrorism so that we are able to cut their ambitions short and we are able to continue to finish achieving our December's revolution objectives.
Ibrahim Gandur of the former National Congress Party, which was dissolved following the former President Omar al-Bashir's ouster, also condemned the attack. Gandur wrote on his Facebook page, "The government must collectively shoulder its responsibility to establish security and prevent the country from descending into chaos in light of the economic hardship and the deteriorating service that the country is witnessing." The U.S. Embassy in Khartoum posted on its social media page that it is shocked and saddened at the attack on Hamdok and offered its condolences to the victims. And British Ambassador to Sudan Irfan Sadiq said in a tweet, "This is a deeply worrying event which must be investigated fully." For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan is expressing concern over the delay in implementing security arrangements in the revitalized peace agreement. The head of the UN mission says despite relative peace in the country, a number of security arrangements, including training of unified forces and redeployment of those forces, is yet to happen. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
David Sierra, special representative of the UN Secretary General to South Sudan, says the delay in implementing certain security arrangements is dangerous. He says the absence of key bodies such as The National Pre-Transitional Committee, or NPTC, and the prolonged announcement of the new transitional government can create more problems.
There is no authority heading it anymore, because with the transitional government forming, the pre-transitional mechanisms like the NPTC, like many of the other institutions that help with the organisation on the ground, are gone. So there's a vacuum, if you like, in terms of leadership.
Sierra says the lack of food, water and equipment at training centres for forces means critical security arrangements are not being carried out. He says not having government officials in place at the state and national level is also causing problems. For 2 weeks after President Salva Kiir agreed to return the country to 10 states plus 3 administrative areas, no cabinet ministers or their subordinates have been appointed. Sierra says the parties must ensure there is strong leadership in place to address existing security challenges in the country.
The parties in good faith agreed that they would form a unified armed forces. So therefore it's important that we see that through. It's very much a central part of the peace agreement. And if we don't do that, or it seemed to be lagging, then one party or another might feel frustrated, angry, etc., and that can create problems.
Sierra says the training of up to 6,000 younger men gathered at cantonment sites must happen. If it doesn't and the men go home and wander off, he says, that can cause more problems. Sierra says the ongoing communal violence in parts of Jonglei State can partly be attributed to the absence of state authorities who would crack down on the perpetrators of communal fighting. He says areas like Lekwangole and Manyabol have been nearly destroyed by a continuous conflict, and there are up to 8,000 displaced persons camping in makeshift structures in Anyide, Gomorok, Manyabol, and Yuai villages. Sierra says he witnessed with his own eyes bodies lying on the streets of Pibor last weekend in the wake of communal fighting there. He says the parties must stick to their commitments made in the peace deal.
In the past weeks, the parties have shown leadership, and we hope that will continue. It's imperative there is no reneging on the peace agreement or, most importantly, of the ceasefire. Finally, the international community, including the UN, must continue to support the peace process. While there will be caution because of past mistakes, we cannot step back. Instead, now is the time to fully engage.
According to Chapter 2 of the Revitalized Peace Agreement, the parties are to complete training and redeployment of unified forces during the pre-transitional period. That aspect of the security arrangements has not materialized. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Jonglei, where a court in the state capital, Bor, has sentenced two health workers to 3 years in prison after they were found guilty of negligence for the death of a 15-year-old patient at a private clinic. The presiding judge says the convictions must also pay 50 cows as compensation. Dengai Deng has this report for VOA from Bor.
South Sudan in Focus reported last January that a 15-year-old girl died after receiving treatment at the African clinic in Bor. Agawa Alier told this program his cousin was admitted to the clinic after being diagnosed with malaria at the facility a week earlier. Jonglei State High Court Judge John Yela Leu, found medical officer Ajeni Stephen and nurse Achan Gloria guilty of medical negligence under Section 191 and 220/1 of the South Sudan Penal Code Act 2008 for the death of the 15-year-old girl.
The court passed his judgment that the first accused Ajeni has been sentenced into imprisonment for 3 years is a medical officer, and the second one, she's a nurse, so she has been sent also into imprisonment for 3 years.
Judge Aliu says Stephen and Gloria will serve their sentences in Bor Central Prison, and they must also compensate the family of the victim with dozens of cattle, according to Dinka custom.
They have to compensate the victim with, according to Dinka custom, 50 head of cattle, together with the African Clinical Demonstration. This is how the decision that take place today.
Judge Aliu says the parties have 15 days to appeal the decision. Defense lawyer James Alier Michael says the judge should have reduced the number of cows paid in compensation to the family of the deceased girl.
African Clinic has a responsibility, has a civil responsibility. And the two accused, as a medical officer and the nurse, they was victimized by negligence. So if there is an negligence in the court procedures, we know it will be half of compensation. So now the court passed his judgment ruling as a full compensation, as in Dinka customer law.
Speaking in Dinka, Amor Jungror Ding, the mother of the victim, says she welcomes the judge ruling.
Sentencing the nurse to death for killing my daughter will not bring her back to life. To do the thing she was doing for me, this was my elder child. She was 15 years old and she finished her primary 8. That means I was hopeful that if educated, my daughter would help me. So the judge has ruled according to what was supposed to be done.
Former Jonglei State Health Minister Dr. Kwai Deng Kwai said in January he knew that unqualified employees worked at various clinics and health facilities across the state. Dr. Kwai urged the owners of all health facilities in Bor to dismiss all unqualified health workers. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Bor.
Still on health matters, Uganda's Ministry of Health has called for the deportation of 22 foreigners from countries that are considered to be at high risk for the coronavirus outbreak. The individuals had arrived to attend the Uganda European Business Forum. VOA's Halima Othomani reports from Kampala.
Three of Margaret Ntale's four children are studying in Wuhan, China, and have been quarantined there since the coronavirus outbreak began in December.
One of my daughters, the young one, Vivian, fell ill, and it scared me so much. And it was a sore throat to the extent that she could not even talk. I was so scared until the point when they told me she didn't have the virus.
Ntale calls her children every day to ask if they are safe and healthy, free of the virus known as COVID-19.
Do they spray every day, spraying the virus?
I'm not sure. I think so. But I'm not sure because I never look outside. But I hear those trucks making noise, so I think they do spray.
But she wishes they were back home in Uganda.
We pleaded with our government to help us evacuate our children, and up to now they refused, and they gave us the reason that they are safer there.
Health Minister Dr. Ruth Acheng confirmed the students will stay in Wuhan for the time being.
I am not aware of the Chinese government requesting us to evacuate. To the contrary, I have a letter from the ambassador reassuring us of how well they are taking care of our Ugandan students.
Acheng also discouraged people from countries where the coronavirus is spreading from coming to Uganda, warning they face a 2-week self-imposed quarantine.
People residing in the following 7 countries: Italy, Iran, South Korea, France, China, Germany, and Spain should consider postponing non-essential travel to Uganda.
Since the outbreak, Ugandan authorities have identified about 1,300 passengers arriving from affected countries as high risk. These travelers, such as traders from Kampala's business hub, Chikubo, pose a threat to public health, says aviation public health specialist Dr. James Ayul.
Ugandans coming from China, you know, our Chikubo traders, for example, they don't want to remain at home. They're a little bit stubborn because they think they're at home. And if we have one which still within the incubation period, that will be the threat.
The best way to prevent the spread of COVID-19, doctors say, is for everyone in affected countries to stay put, limit physical contact, and wait for the virus to stop spreading. But for mothers like Ntale, the waiting is the hardest part. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese students are stranded in Ethiopia. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could relive an age, what age would you like to be?
I would like to go back to my secondary school days. Because there are other things that I see that I did not do well. I was very childish.
I would say that the age between 20 and 22nd. By that time, I think I was very more handsome than today. And I was energetic than today.
That's 18, because it's the time I enjoyed most. I got to know more about life, what the world is all about.
I would like to be at the age of 17. Because at that time, we go out. We go out for hunting, playing football, or a lot of entertaining activities.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Hundreds of South Sudanese students on a government scholarship are stranded without money in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, after the government failed to pay for their scholarship program. David Mono Danga has the story for VOA from Juba.
Stranded South Sudanese students who were attending Civil Service University in Addis Ababa say they have received threats and have been intimidated by South Sudan embassy officials in Ethiopia for speaking to the media. Here is one South Sudanese student who was in Addis but returned to Juba and spoke to us on condition of anonymity for safety reasons.
According to the agreement, the government of Ethiopia is supposed to provide the tuition fee, the accommodation, and the feeding. Meanwhile, the government of South Sudan is supposed to cater for the upkeep, medical, and the traveling. The government is no longer providing anything.
A female South Sudanese student in Addis, who also declined to be identified for safety reasons and spoke to Ethiopian journalist Sisai Silo with the Daily Monitor, says she cannot pay for normal daily expenses.
Transport is taking us more than what this government of Ethiopia is offering us here. I went to the director of student service. I complained about my sickness because I have chest problem. I complained to him saying I cannot use cool water anymore. And as a woman, I cannot live without shower. Simply, he told me if you cannot cope with the situation, just withdraw and go home.
When contacted by South Sudan in Focus, the South Sudanese embassy in Ethiopia refused to comment on this story. Israel Behene, an Ethiopian freelance journalist who is also reporting on the stranded students, says South Sudan embassy officials kept postponing his appointment for an interview by several weeks.
I called the ambassador several times and even left him a text message, but he did not respond. So I decided to go to the embassy myself. I met the deputy ambassador, but he was even not willing to talk. Rather, he directed me to the education attaché. All three officials, they refused to talk on record.
Simon Mikanipare, regional coordinator for the Catholic Diocese of Tombora and Yambio, says he met the students while applying for a foreign visa in Addis Ababa. Mekani Pare says the student's situation is bad. He says he promised the church's support.
Others have to eat first, and whatever is left is what now they combine and give to our students.
Wendy Mumoges, director of public and international relations at the Civil Service University, says the school was not trying to segregate foreign students from nationals, but admits it did open a separate restaurant for international students.
After an assessment by our university officials and also complaints from the students who didn't want to be isolated from the larger segment of the main student's cafe, we have found that the restaurant was unnecessary because we wanted to encourage student socialization.
Adil Atanasio Surur, the undersecretary in South Sudan's Higher Education, Science and Technology Ministry, admits some students on full scholarship were cut off due to hard economic times.
So they are the next group, 2016-2017 upward, they are not getting this support in Ethiopia.
Surur says whenever their money arrives, the students will receive it. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
United Nations investigators accuse South Sudanese leaders of widespread corruption and trampling on the rights and fundamental freedoms of their people. The UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan presented its latest report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Commission accuses South Sudan's leaders of deliberately starving their people while brazenly looting and plundering the country's wealth. Commission Chair Yasmin Suka says these economic crimes have dire humanitarian consequences, especially for women and children.
Corruption has made several officials extremely wealthy at the expense of millions of their starving citizens. It affects every sector of the economy and every state institution. These are some of the same officials who fought for independence to improve the lot of their people and who have rapidly turned the dream of liberation into a nightmare.
Suka says some South Sudanese leaders have stolen tens of millions of dollars from the government treasury that should have been used to feed their people. She says the plunder of resources has turned this potentially oil-rich young country into the third worst place in the world in which to live. The report documents the recruitment of children by both the government and opposition forces. The UN Children's Fund reports some 19,000 children were still being used by the warring parties. Suka says the commission has documented a wide range of sexual and gender-based crimes against women and girls perpetrated with impunity by both government and opposition forces.
Sexual and gender-based violence continue to be systematically used by the armed parties in the conflict to terrorize and subjugate civilian populations. In particular, South Sudanese women and girls continue to face rape, gang rape, sexual mutilation, forced marriage, abduction, and sexualized torture.
South Sudan's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Marwan Makol Arik, did not acknowledge any of the commission's blistering accusations of widespread government corruption. He glossed over the panel's findings into issues such as sexual abuse, the use of starvation as a tactic of war, recruitment of child soldiers, and the erosion of civic freedoms. Instead, he put a positive spin on the actions taken by his government. He noted that dozens of media agencies were operating freely and without censorship in the country. He said his government had signed two action plans with UN support to improve human rights. One, he noted, strengthens the ability of the judiciary to try cases of gender crimes and child abuse. The other, he said, is a plan to release child soldiers and reunite them with their families. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Relatives of victims in last year's Ethiopian airline crash have arrived in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, to commemorate the anniversary of the tragedy and to get answers. An airline industry final report on what caused the Boeing 737 MAX to crash is expected this week. Simon Max has the story for VOA from Addis Ababa.
Families of the 157 victims on board Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 are holding memorials in Addis Ababa Monday, before travelling Tuesday to the crash site, about 45 kilometres outside the capital, for a private ceremony. At a small gathering at the French embassy Monday, Relatives of the 9 French citizens killed in the March 10 crash commemorated their lost loved ones. There were no survivors when the nearly new Boeing 737 MAX crashed, just minutes after takeoff. Virginie Fricaudet is president of the victims' association, ET302 Solidarity Justice. She lost her 38-year-old brother Xavier, a teacher at the French school in Nairobi.
I would say that we have created like a community between all families, the French families on one side and the other global families on the other side. So I would say that it's a big and huge moment of being all together because we are linked by the same tragedy and destiny. So it's a moment we should live like a big family.
Surviving relatives have asked for Boeing not to be involved in the anniversary memorials and have filed lawsuits against the company to seek compensation. Their visit to Ethiopia comes as air safety investigators are expected to release an interim report on the roles played by Boeing, the US Federal Aviation Administration, and Ethiopian Airlines. Relatives and friends of the victims are still waiting for answers and remain critical of how the aftermath of the crash was handled, including by Ethiopian Airlines. Yeshawas Zegeya was president of the Airline Pilots Association of Ethiopia at the time of the crash.
What's quite interesting up to this point is the company did not have a consultation with pilots and cabin crews at all after the crash. That isn't something that I would have expected. So I would expect the company would engage more with its pilots, especially those who flew on the same airplane, Boeing 737 MAX at the time.
Zegeya also criticized Ethiopian Airlines for not acting after the Lion Air crash in Indonesia, also a 737 MAX, that took place months earlier. Relatives of the Ethiopian Airlines crash victims agree the 737 MAX should have been grounded soon after the Lion Air crash. Aviation engineer and vice president of ET302 Solidarity Justice, Mathieu Wilm, says Boeing needs to explain why the 737 MAX aircraft were allowed to continue flying.
After the first crash, my opinion is that Boeing should have said, hey, we have a problem with the design. We should ground the fleet and investigate. But they didn't. Actually, the second crash is very different from the first one because after the first one, they discovered some design problem, some certification problem and so on. So it's a chain of events leading to an accident. But for the second one, the pilots applied the procedure and the aircraft crashed anyway. So there is a problem and they should have ground the fleet at that time.
A US congressional report last week into the crash accused Boeing of concealing crucial information from the FAA, making faulty assumptions about critical technologies and production pressures that jeopardized aviation safety. Boeing did not immediately reply to a request for comment. But in public statements, the company has said it will review the report, continue to cooperate with investigators, and that its thoughts and prayers are with the relatives who lost loved ones. Boeing last year set aside $100 million to assist the families of victims and communities impacted by the crashes, which killed 346 people in total. The funds are not part of any compensation the aircraft maker might have to pay to those who are suing the company for damages. Boeing has said it is strengthening safety measures and estimates it will be able to recertify the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft for use around the middle of this year. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Achanika Kimia by Diamond. I'm John Tanza in Washington, and thanks for listening. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Unanambia tisimba japunguruma uiseme haki. Unajaribu kunyamaza atalaiza tagio. Anasema wala unena kidogo. Na mashabiki dangote wananambia mbona usemi chochote. Ah, siuko na usiku zote. Ama ulezi unafanya uogope. Ah, na media pande zote
wanalalama kiongozi atoke, nchi inaingia matope, niende wapi na mimi mtoto wote, yani lawama nichonge kimya, ninyamaze mimi kimya, nisiseme kimya, mama kanambia nifunge mudomo, nipato mudoko sana, nisiseme